Good afternoon and welcome. This is session 365. Is there really any problem with Joseph Smith's first vision and why not? Our presenter tonight, this afternoon, is Richard Behrens. His biographical information is that after finishing his undergraduate studies in economics at Dartmouth College in 1964, he completed his postgraduate studies in economics at Northwestern University, where he developed a deep interest in economic history. A long career in corporate banking and finance followed, with a particular interest in how and why economic systems succeed and fail. For 6 years prior to his retirement in 2004, he began cultivating an interest in the history of Upper New England and its relationship to Southern and Western expansion in general, and Mormonism in particular. He has presented at various Mormon History Association and John Whitmer Historical Association conferences. His main area of research focuses on the Dartmouth mission to the Indians and its interaction with Mormonism in the Upper Connecticut River Valley to Western New York, and then on to Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, Iowa, Oregon, California, and the Great Basin. He focuses his attention on the emergence of the Prophet Joseph Smith and his continuing impact long after the environment from which he emerged changed beyond recognition. Richard lives in Brentwood, California. The responder today will be John Hatch. John is well known to Sunstone participants. John is the editor of Signature Books, Significant Diary Series, Volume Danish Apostles, Diaries of Anthon H. Lund. He is a former managing editor of Sunstone Magazine and a coordinator of the Sunstone Symposiums. He's now back attending school at the University of Utah and nearing completion of a degree in history, and tells me he plans to go on to graduate school. He's married to Emily, and they have two children, Ethan and Matthew. We'll turn the time over to Mr. Behrens and then directly to John, and if there's time, we'll take questions from the audience. Please make sure that all noise-making devices, especially your cell phones, are turned off. And again, welcome to this session.
If I thank you very much for attending. Based on other presentations I've seen so far, I'm going to choose to have a rather tight chronology in my presentation of the environment that the Prophet Joseph Smith emerged from. His family's interaction with that environment, the community discourse, and the family discourse, which seems to be pretty well documented, documenting this interaction between the two. I'd like to begin in 1800. I just arbitrarily picked that date because that's when Hiram Smith is born, and it appears as though Joseph Smith Sr. and his brothers and his brothers-in-law have had their first deep immersion in Masonry. So far as to name Hiram after the key figure in the Masonic myth, Hiram Abiff. And just to see, we have a small group, but I'd just like to ask, do we have anybody who's related in any way to Heber C. Kimball in the audience? No, that's surprising, because Kimball used to be able to take virtually any street car when he left the church office building and go home. And he has quite a posterity, and numbered in probably 30,000 or so. I'm a little surprised we don't have someone. But just as a quick aside to start with, in that same environment in 1800, Heber C. Kimball winds up getting his name, because the people who started the Freemason Lodge in Randolph, Vermont, that Joseph Smith Sr. had his first introduction to masonry with. The man in charge, Dudley Chase, was the employer of Salmon Farnham Kimball, Heber C. Kimball's father, and Dudley Chase's son died, and his name was Heber Chase. He was a doctor, died prematurely, and the family was very upset. So Heber Chase's father decides to name Heber Chase after him to replace the lost son of his employer. So sometimes there's a story deep in the web that unravels later in time. And it's also interesting that Heber Chase winds up being, Chase Kimball, winds up being one of Joseph's strongest supporters and comes from the Freemasonry side along with Brigham Young. So let me go on from there and say that the next thing of importance, once Freemasonry is introduced to the family, is that Lucy, in 1803-1804, has her first, what I would call, real spiritual experience. She has her dream where she sees her husband versus the inflexible Jesse lined up against each other. And I think for the first time we see the dream element enter the Smith family. Nearby, this revival is just not local-centric. It's fairly broad. And over at Dartmouth College, a fellow named Roswell Shurtleff, who was a cousin of Lumen Shurtleff, and there might be some relatives of the current Utah Attorney General around here somewhere in the conference, but Roswell Shurtleff has his first epiphany and begins a tradition in the area, immediate area where the Smith family is involved, of resolution of deep problems through praying in the woods, praying in the grove, and receiving an epiphany. Next, the year after those two events, Joseph is born. Then additional siblings arrive. But now I think it's important to keep sequence in mind. In 1811, as before the Smith family leaves Royalton, Vermont, there's another big revival. And who is it instigated by? Roswell Shurtleff. There's a battle going on between the Arminians, who are Free Willists, and the Calvinists. This is the circumstance in which Joseph Smith Sr. has his dream of the animals attacking each other, and he comes up with the two big rhetorical questions. What is true religion? Where is true religion? What plan of salvation? You know, when he's reacting to the violent revival of 1811. 1811 is also important because this is when the Joseph Smith Jr. family leaves their family confines of the White River Valley, and they move to Lebanon, New Hampshire. It's also important that this is the very time that Lucy describes that they're doing well enough to establish their son Hiram at the academy in Hanover. So now we have the first physical connection between the Dartmouth College environment where Hiram was in school and the Smith family itself. We had a Dartmouth influence with the Freemasons up in Randolph, but this is the first on-site experience. It's interesting. right after moving to Lebanon, Joseph Smith has what I call his second dream, the family unity and separation dream, where it's very clear in the dream itself that he is trying to rally the family together now that they're alone, without extended family support. It's also clear that he sees a threat to family unity, the big tall building that gets echoed later on in the Book of Mormon itself. But now, what had he just done? What did Joseph Smith Sr. just do? He dropped Hiram off at school. There was a big tall building on campus, four stories high, where all the students gathered up on the top so they could watch the sunset over the Vermont hills. As Joseph Smith Sr. left, it appears as though when he was looking back, he saw people looking down on him and threatening his family with the separation of one of his sons. So the dream itself is very coherent when looked at in terms of the context. Now, let us look at what else is happening right in 1811 when Hiram goes to school. Well, for one thing, the Dartmouth Medical School has been drastically expanded in 1811. There had been just up to a maximum of 15 students in one room. The state of New Hampshire provided additional funding. So it was possible now in 1812, with the lectures actually in November of 1811, going through 1812, for a key doctor, Nathan Smith, who was the founder of the medical school, the fourth graduate of the Harvard Medical School, he was able to expand his lectures from 15 students to 150 by some rather clever techniques. First of all, he offered the first science electives in America to the undergraduate body at Dartmouth, and half of the student body signed up for the medical lectures. Then he offered the first continuing education program that I can find in America by allowing the poorly trained doctors from the Revolutionary War and so forth to come in and take the lectures and fill the rest of the seats. This wound up being very fortuitous, because what happened just as the lecture series was completed, the typhoid epidemic of 1812-1813 hit. Massive chaos in the Upper Connecticut and White River valleys. 6,000 people died along the river. 1,500 north of Massachusetts. Only one died within 30 miles of Dartmouth because Nathan Smith instituted triage. He told the students what to do, how to clean the linens, towels, segregate water, and kept the epidemic under control on campus. Told the same thing to the doctors in the region, and they kept the regional control, and that left him in a position to fill the gaps on difficult cases. Who winds up being the difficult case? Joseph Smith. 1813, 4 months into the, in March, 4 months into the epidemic, Joseph has really gone through hell, literally. He has had the typhoid. He's been operated on twice, trying to remove abscesses from his leg. And they finally are able to call in the triage guy, the final backstop, Nathan Smith, and he does the index finger size removal of bone from Joseph's leg. Now, the thing that helps is triage again. Close examination of Dr. Smith's daybook shows that he was able to see Joseph 18 times in 20 days during that healing process, you know, for getting the removal of any infection. The next highest number of visits during that period was to another fellow named Chauncey Adams, who had 6 visits. So you can see that Joseph Smith was a focus of Dr. Smith's attention. Where does that leave us right now? It's a critical point, 1813. For a year, Joseph is pretty much carried around. He's immobile. His leg is heavily casted for a year or so, and then for 3 years he's on crutches. According to his own record, as soon as he arrives in Palmyra in 1817, 4 years after the surgery, he's concerned for the welfare of his soul as an 11-year-old. You know, so there's, what happened? You know, what's going on? And again, a careful look at the records indicates that the critical year was 1814, 1815, right at the end of the War of 1812. There's another massive revival. What happens at this revival? Well, a number of things. One, Ethan Smith's work on the character of Christ and the Godhead is studied very carefully, because that the Godhead is a subject of interest in the 1814-1815 revival. What else is going on in the revival? Well, there's a very well documented epiphany that again echoes Shurtleff's epiphany. And since he was the instigator of the revival, there seems to have been some connection there, that he is reinforcing the notion of praying in the woods, going out and getting that spiritual interaction which would generate epiphanies. And what happens? There's an epiphany, a really big one, that is well documented. It has, you know, a little different character structure. It has two guys who are talking to each other initially, and one is concerned about the welfare of his soul, and the second says, well, why don't we go and walk in the woods and go to, and they knelt down in a grove of trees and were praying. And there's A and there's B. And B hears a thud. He looks over, and A has kind of fallen down, fallen over. And he brings him up, and A now is, oh, everything's great. I saw this flash of light. I'm not concerned about my salvation. I'm okay. Now, what happens around that? I'm okay. Well, I studied the record again. Of the students that observed this or participated in this revival, including Hiram Smith and his cousin Stephen Mack, 20 of them spent the rest of their lives in missionary work, and I would include Hiram in that, and Stephen in that. And they were with the Indians, or they went to India, or they went to Turkey, or one thing or another. So something happened in 1815 on that campus that changed the lives of many people. And I can't find anything similar before, and I can't find anything similar afterwards. The letters, Hiram doesn't mention it. He doesn't mention anything from this period. But other students who participated in it would say, this is the greatest thing since apostolic times. The great millennial day is here. The president of the college, writing to his sister, says, Zion is here. I've never seen any spiritual outpouring like this ever before. So this dynamic environment was the situation that occurred within the Dartmouth community and within the Smith family participation in it, and was carried as a part of the cultural baggage from New England to Palmyra. Okay, now, once we get to Palmyra, what's happening? Well, a lot of people are concerned about dates, you know, on when. Well, let me back up and get one other sermon that was given in that 1815 revival. It was given by Roswell Shurtleff again. And when they were discussing the Godhead, they were going through all the scriptural texts and so forth, trying to establish, you know, some way to visualize the Godhead. And Shurtleff clearly says, well, there's only one piece that I find that helps me visualize it, and that's Stephen's vision, where Stephen sees God the Father and God the Son next to each other in the heavens. So now we've got a whole series of pieces that are carried in the cultural baggage to Palmyra. I would tend to opt for an earlier rather than a later date for Joseph's vision, first vision, simply because, again, how does it tie in with Joseph Sr.'s dreams? We've talked about a couple of his dreams. I'll skip the third one, go to the fourth one. The fourth one takes place in Palmyra, Manchester probably, where Hiram and Alvin and Joseph Smith Sr. have just cleared a lot of land for cultivation. There appear to have been a number of revivals in the area, and it's interesting that his dream culminates with the following language, which again comes directly out of both the Dartmouth environment and the Palmyra revivals, where he focuses in on the atonement. Joseph Smith Sr. in Dream 4 is focused on the atonement now. The Christ the mediator, Christ the advocate, the very language that Hiram was steeped in from that previous experience. So now we've got Joseph Smith's vision, and if we look at it in that overall context, what do we see? We've got the woods, we've got the grove of trees, we've got the praying, we've got the white light, and the gods visualized in Stephen's vision are now here and now rather than out there somewhere. So Joseph, one way or another, has a vision that is totally consistent and almost expected from the previous developing context. I want to leave the first vision there and take a quick jump and look at the Book of Mormon for a moment. First, let's just see if we go ahead to 1823 and the visitation of the angel Moroni. What has just transpired at the same time? Well, the first version of View of the Hebrews comes out from Ethan Smith. Ethan Smith relied very heavily on Elias Boudinot's book, which came out in 1816, which was also discussed at Dartmouth before the Smith family left to go to Palmyra. There are a number of fascinating things in this book, but the one I love is the resurrected Indian that comes down and visits one of his relatives and explains to him, you know, the Indian is praying, wants to know how he can learn more of the Great Spirit, and the resurrected Indian comes down to tell him what he needs to do. So that book itself has a foreshadowing of the angel Moroni. And it's incorporated in Ethan Smith's book also. So in 1823, we've got that coincidence. 1824, we have a second edition of the Godhead book. And then the second edition of A View of the Hebrews comes out in 1825. Now, Joseph really doesn't get going in earnest on the Book of Mormon basically until April of 1829. He gets the plates, he has his faux pas with Martin Harris in 1828, where he loses the first part of the translation. But it's interesting to look at the participant there. Oliver Cowdery comes from the Ethan Smith world. His family was in the congregation of Ethan Smith. All of Ethan Smith's books were written and published in the hometown there in Pulteney, Vermont. So it appears as though Oliver was an ideal match for Joseph because they could operate, you know, with almost a similar vocabulary. They were both familiar with the works of Ethan Smith. And it is fascinating that the Book of Mormon uses exactly the same terms for anything related to to deity that Ethan Smith does. So there seems to be a common vocabulary that has entered the game and winds up being a part of the Book of Mormon itself. So now, once the Book of Mormon is out, I just want to kind of close with a couple comments. First, let's go back to Joseph for a moment and say, what type of capability did Joseph Smith have in the 1830 time frame? This would be right after the Book of Mormon and before the translation of the Bible. He wrote a letter that's a fascinating one that Bill Hartley has analyzed, Bill Hartley from BYU. It's a one-pager that he wrote to Joseph Knight. And he was trying to make some points and clarify things for Joseph Knight. So he wrote a letter that has 50 phrases from throughout the Bible seamlessly integrated into a letter that makes his points so clearly that Joseph Knight, you know, just is totally convinced that Joseph can communicate with him. He understands Joseph. So I think what we find is that I think Joseph even mentioned maybe to his mother that in if he spent 2 months reading the Bible, he could get more out of it than she could by going to school for 2 years. So we've got a fellow here who was extremely alert on one hand, and he was constantly impacted by an environment that was favorably stimulating his entire set of efforts. I'd like to just say a lot of people like to go through things year by year by year, beginning, and not look backwards. Because when you look backwards, you wind up with all sorts of, you get things in the wrong place, and a lot of anachronisms. And I think this is one of the issues that I'd like to close with. When people talk about the various versions of the first vision, I like to look back at the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where Sidney and Joseph both see the Godhead the same way Joseph did before, but in Johnson's home. And that's 1832. And there's no mention of Joseph articulating his first vision prior to that in any detail that we can work with. So if Joseph could articulate the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, and he, for one purpose or another, in 1832, when he talked about his first vision, he limited the amount of material that he was willing to discuss at that point in time. I just don't see any reason to think that he is enhancing the story through time. He can tell the story differently through time for different purposes, but all the information that winds up in 1838 is known in 1832. So I think I've covered the period that I wanted to, from 1800 to 1832. I've tried to focus all of my attention on what was happening immediately around Joseph. I was not trying to talk about somebody who was 200 miles away, who was out of time sequence. You know, I hear that a lot of times. I just think that if we look at the process here of incrementing the calendar, the chronology, year by year, we have a better feeling for what Joseph knew and when he knew it. Thank you very much.
I think Richard's given us a really detailed and marvelous recitation of these early and often forgotten parts of Mormonism. He's done a great job of pulling together both primary and secondary sources that we frequently miss, particularly the Nathan Smith things, to put together a pretty tight chronology and context for the first vision, and I'm certainly not going to challenge him on it because that's more research than I wanted to do. So what I'm going to talk about, what interests me about the first vision, I suppose I'm kind of a curious person to respond because I'm somewhat defensive of Joseph's memory of the first vision, and yet I confess I'm also something of a non-believer in it. And what I see the first vision as is something of a Rorschach test for belief in Mormonism, if you look at least the varying accounts of the first vision. If you're a believer, you insist there's really no differences. Joseph Smith is just emphasizing different points to different audiences. He's pointing out different things, that sort of thing. If you're a non-believer, you insist that this is a huge event in this young man's life. How could he possibly forget these different things or say that, you know, there were two people there in one case and one in another, or angels in one case and not in another? Who would do such a thing? I think both perspectives are fairly short-sighted, and I think they neglect issues of memory, which are fascinating to me. I don't pretend to be any expert, any scientist, but I do have sort of an armchair interest in the concept of memory and how we remember things. And I give Joseph Smith the benefit of the doubt that he remembers this event. There has been enough research done, although we know very little about memory, to tell us that we re-remember and recreate events after a fairly short period of time when we go back and remember them. Keep in mind that this was supposedly 12 years after the event that Joseph first reported on it. And each time we remember a particular event in our life, we will actually recreate it in our brain. And it will actually, and that, of course, and it will be done, of course, through our current lens and current worldview at the time. And so we can easily emphasize other things, forget different things, move things around, even change things altogether. This is why 100 years ago, an eyewitness to a crime was foolproof. I saw him do it, and we relied very heavily on that. And now, We know that eyewitness accounts are particularly unreliable, and it's not at all uncommon to get very differing accounts of the same event that people saw. Witness, for example, the fact that roughly 40% of the people in Dealey Plaza on November 22, 1963, distinctly remember shots being fired from the grassy knoll, whereas another 50% remember them coming from the Texas Book Depository and the remaining people from various areas, and they are equally certain of what they heard. And this is the case with many different kinds of events. And so I see this fascinating thing with the first vision where people look at it and nuance it and finesse it into what they need it to be. What's curious about the first vision is its role in Mormon culture today. It seems that today Mormons place far more emphasis on the first vision than Joseph Smith himself probably did. It's something that he talked about just those few times, or at least in writing, and bothered to talk about. And as Kathleen Flake has done very, very well, she's demonstrated that the first vision did not become important in Mormonism until the late 19th and really early 20th century. And I think understood in that context, we can appreciate this fight over the first vision, this emphasis on what these four accounts from Joseph Smith mean. Because understood in that context, we see that Mormons have embraced the first vision, and ironically, critics have done so as well, as this black and white yes or no issue. As Mormons themselves have said, it either happened or it didn't, and if it happened, well then, Joseph Smith is a prophet, and the Book of Mormon is true. And ironically, critics seem to have gone along with that and said, yes, so if we can discredit this, then, well, there you go. Really, the first vision came about in the context, or the importance of it came about in the context of the Smoot hearings. So you have, in 1904, Reed Smoot going to Congress and hearings held so that Congress could determine whether or not he wanted, or whether or not they were going to give him his seat. You have Joseph F. Smith, called as the first witness, put on trial, and a very difficult, painful time for the church. Can you possibly imagine Thomas S. Monson put before Congress and asked, "Have you ever had a revelation?" "No, I haven't." And how that might impact the culture today, because that's precisely what happened. Covered in the newspapers every single day, accounts of the temple ceremony published openly in the Washington Post, among other newspapers. This was a huge event in Mormon history, and it's finally getting some of the attention it deserves because of Kathleen Flake and Mike Paulos and others. But here you have this coinciding in 1905 with Joseph Smith's 100th birthday. Invitations are published in the Deseret News. A huge celebration is held that December in Salt Lake City. You have, of course, Joseph F. Smith, Anton H. Lund, and others boarding a train. They ride all the way to the East Coast, to Vermont, where they erect and dedicate a monument in Sharon, where Joseph Smith was born. And you see this shift in Mormonism from Mormon divinity being proven through theology to Mormon divinity being proven through history. And instead of an emphasis on polygamy, which was of course going away at the time, and an emphasis on we have the true theology, you have this emphasis put on history, where Joseph Smith saw God. Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith did this. Joseph Smith did that. And all of a sudden, Mormons begin to construct their identity on their history. And whenever you therefore talk about history, and that's what we've seen very recently in the last 20 years and a little bit longer with the rise of the new Mormon history, you see a threat to that Mormon identity, and you see a threat to Mormon belief in their own divinity, because you're challenging that, because that is where it comes from. It does not come from, by and large, the theology. And so you see this fascinating battle over the first vision, when if you step back and look at it, we have almost nothing on the first vision. We have four sources. We have people who believe that the government was responsible for the most recorded event in human history, September 11th. People can't even agree on that, and yet we're supposed to take these four sources and insist that they're all good enough. And it's a fascinating thing in Mormon history that we seem to take a handful of sources, at least for the Joseph Smith period, and think that this is the whole story. And clearly it is not. And so these are just my somewhat random approaches to the first vision. I'm not nearly as interested in whether or not how Joseph Smith remembered it as I am its place in Mormon history today or in Mormon culture today, because it is something that people seem to grasp onto. And it was interesting to note a shift, at least from my perspective, in the way the first vision was talked about when the Book of Mormon began to be questioned a little bit because of, and of course it always has been, I mean, not to say that this is a new debate, but to see some things come up and the new challenge to the Book of Mormon, if you will, through DNA. The Book of Mormon, it seemed, used to be the thing that we said, well, if you pray about the Book of Mormon and it's true, well, then Joseph Smith is a prophet. And it was curious to watch something of a shift away from that be placed and then go back to the first vision. Well, if Joseph Smith had this first vision, then the Mormon church was true. And so, again, you see this debate back and forth over it, and it remains such an essential part of Mormon culture. And what fascinates me, again, is this use of history to construct Mormon identity. And so you see this challenge over the first vision, despite a fairly small amount of sources for it, this trust in memory and that sort of thing. I wanted to finish with just one last example of that, because I think Richard does a very good job of bringing up dreams, particularly Joseph Smith Sr.'s dreams. And I wanted to share the story of Wilford Woodruff and his vision of the Founding Fathers, something we've all heard about. And they appeared to him, of course, in the St. George Temple, and he was told to do their temple work. Well, for those of you who have read it, we have Brian Stye's excellent, excellent article that analyzes this, because as it turns out, all of those Founding Fathers who appeared to Wilford Woodruff and said, you need to do our temple work, had already had all of their temple work done. And it raises the question of, well, what happened? Are we to say that Wilford Woodruff made this up, much like we might say, did Joseph Smith make up the first vision? And what Brian concludes, and I think is worth examining, is that it was very common for Wilford Woodruff to equate dreams to visions. And he was able to put forth the hypothesis that I think is probably pretty accurate, that Wilford Woodruff had a dream and equated that with a vision or even a visitation, and said that, well, now I have to go do this, and I suspect and that may be similar to what happened with Joseph Smith, because I don't personally see him making up the first vision, and I think it's perfectly reasonable to explain issues of memory for the differences in each of those differing accounts, but again, then I come at it from a little bit different perspective. So I hope that's an appropriate response to Richard's paper. I think he's done an excellent job, again, compiling these sources that are often neglected. I don't know how much time we have, but let's have questions for the next 15 minutes. Thank you.
I've always heard the first vision story in the context of the Palmyra revival, and maybe I missed it, but I don't see that in your chronology. And I'm remembering specifically the research of the Reverend Wesley Walters, where he seemed to prove, at least to my mind, that there was no revival in 1820, but there was in 1824, and it fit all the circumstances. And his conclusion was that the whole chronology is just blown away, the visit of Moroni and everything else. How have you dealt with that, or is this research?
Well, I'd say if you didactically say that we're going to Bible, if you sit down and say there was no revival, it'd be nice to prove there was no revival. There were revivals from 1816 right on through 1824. They were constantly all over the place.
But part of the revival was great multitudes joining the churches. And he showed that the Palmyra churches even lost membership in 1820.
That's true. That could be. That could be.
So he was conflating these.
Well, he was basically making massive assumptions that these other revivals were irrelevant. And what I'm suggesting is that if you look at Joseph Smith Sr.'s dream and pull it into 1818 time frame, there's revival going on there. Everybody can document it. It's the Vienna one. It's happening. It's there. And that's what he seems to be talking about in his dream at that point in time. Now, there are additional revivals. And to make the assumption that's in the Walters piece is that things couldn't happen unless everything was happening at the highest possible level. That's a big assumption. That was, at the end, that was the biggest, but it was constantly rolling forward almost year by year from the time that the Smiths arrived. And my point is, it was coming from the previous thing, too. They had been through, before they ever got to Palmyra, they had been through three revivals in Vermont. You know, so this process, I believe, is a building process. And to try to stack all the cards the way Walters does and assume everything had to happen at the epitome or at the highest point, I can't buy it. You know, it's possible, but what's going on the rest of the time? What are they doing? Why are they going through the process incrementally? If everything, you know, this whole period is a logical extension of the previous period, and if the previous period hadn't have been happening, then I'd be more sympathetic to the notion that these guys were too dumb and insensitive to know what was going on, and it took the Big Bang to get them interested. But if they were really participating, as I believe they were, from 1814 to 1811 to 1814-15 to 1816-17-18, like that, then the 1820 date makes all the sense in the world. Pardon me.
We'll stay there, please. A couple of questions. First question, and you may or may not be able to answer this. Do you know which side Ethan Smith, in his book, The Character of Christ, fell on the question of the eternal sonship of Christ? In other words, was he eternally the Son, or did he become the Son in the birth of the time of his birth? Secondly, your research parallels some of Forrest Baker's research. Have you worked with Forrest? And if so, how would you describe your views as different from his?
Let's take it in reverse. I haven't worked with him, and I haven't studied him. So let's just work on the first two. Ethan Smith, in his Sonship, when he works on the Godhead, he does not differentiate Father-Son. That becomes the debate at Dartmouth. That is Roswell Shurtleff's sermon, where he says his sermon on the Sonship establishes the dual Godhead in that environment of discussion, and he uses the example of Stephen. And that's how he attempts to zero in to his audience. This is Roswell Shurtleff now. He's the guy with the last word, not Ethan Smith, at the time of the Dartmouth phenomena. When it comes out again in 1824, Ethan Smith is still pushing his version, you know, 10 years later, guess what? That's what the Book of Mormon sounds like. It sounds more like Ethan Smith at this point in time. And that's why I'm saying Joseph's first vision sounds like Roswell shirtless. And they're very close in time, you know, within 5 years. Now, when you jump 5 years in the other direction, and Joseph now is in an environment where Ethan Smith is reigning pretty heavily, 1823, 1824, 1825. Oliver Cowdery knows Ethan Smith's vocabulary. Joseph Smith knows Ethan Smith's vocabulary. When they're working together to produce the final wording of the Book of Mormon, it comes out Ethan Smith, because that's the vocabulary they're using at the time. Later on, when Joseph gets to the point where he does something like the Book of Abraham, there's a very clear duality by that point. But in the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, which comes out in 1832, the first time that a comment on the first vision comes out, Joseph and Sidney both claim to have experienced the same type of relationship with deity that Joseph claims for the first vision. So you have to look at who the influences are incrementally going forward. And Joseph, in my opinion, is absorbing vocabulary from his surroundings. I don't think he's changing his, you know, deep theological views, if he had them, as much as he is adopting language from iteratively as it is popular in what's around him. Because Joseph, all of his work is designed to resonate with his audience. And as things change slightly through time, you could see Joseph changing through time. And maybe going backwards, back and forth. You know, for example, the first division, if we use the 1820 time frame with duality, the 1832 duality, the Book of Mormon singularity, you know, it's a little hard to reconcile.
What are the best primary sources for Joseph having reported a vision during his teenage years? I mean, the Walters camp, Tanner camp type of people, they'll argue that it simply wasn't reported any vision at all during that time period. But yet in Mormon Enigma, I know that there's some reference made to at least one contemporary account occurring, but I'm not that familiar with it. I'm curious if you could tell me what other primary sources do we have, or even secondary sources that would indicate that Joseph did, in fact, say something about a vision in his 14th or 15th year.
The only thing I've ever seen are intimations that he had talked to his father, and his father may or may not have been fully supportive, but I don't see anything hard writing first-hand primary evidence of it, because I think what Joseph was up against is he had no need in his mind up front. You know, because I look at Joseph's first depiction of his vision as being very similar to the worthiness epiphanies that had taken place that he knew about. That it was a validation of his need to go forward, as opposed to a point of doctrinal development. And I think the first doctrinal development of the Godhead, in my opinion, is in the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. That's the first time I see anything in writing that would indicate that Joseph and Sidney had talked about it.
So will the 1832
Well, I'll tell you, there's very little in the 1838 that isn't in the 76 section of Doctrine and Covenants. You know, he goes out and justifies no churches, don't join other churches, and so forth. But I'm just thinking the Godhead itself. There's nothing that I find in the 38 version that wasn't in the 76 section of Doctrine and Covenants in 32.
I just had, well, I had a comment and then a question for Richard. On the earlier issue of revivals in the Palmyra area, it does look like there, from what I understand of the evidence, that there was no revival really in Palmyra or Manchester at that time. There had been in 1816, 1817, which Joseph Smith later refers to. He says when he was about 12 years old, there were revivals that led him to read the Bible. That's the 1832 account. And then Mike Quinn has a fairly recent paper online in Dialogue Paperless that talks about revivals, shows that there were revivals around, but not in Palmyra, like 20 miles away, and such during that time period.
Right, in that time period, 20 miles was not a... are you finished? You
want to I had a question with that. I was particularly curious about a couple things that you'd said. The resurrected Indian, I was wondering if you could say more about that and where I learn more about that incident. And then you had mentioned some indication that maybe Joseph Smith had told his father about the first vision, and he may or may not have accepted it at the time. I was wondering if you recall where you had come across that.
You're going to have to help me through, because my mind only goes four deep.
But I think the issue of, you know, I actually opt for earlier dates than later dates. And if you look at Joseph himself, when he recorded in his history about when his leg operation took place, he said it took place when he was 5 years old. It took place when he was 7 years old. So he was 2 years off on that one. And that could be after consulting with his mother, who had nailed it at 1813 in her first version of the history. Her first edition of her history has the thing in 1813. And Joseph knew he was born in 1805, and 5 years later he's just 3 years off on the date. So I think that's why I always like to roll forward and then try to account for these periods of time. You know, was anything happening? Was nothing happening? And sometimes the family record doesn't show a whole lot, but there's a whole lot of documented material that puts the family into that environment, even though they had no specific response to it. In the case of Lucy's history, though, there's a remarkable correlation between the dreams, for example, and the revivals happening around them. Let's just hit, just prompt me for a couple of those others, and I'll do the best I can. The Indian is Elias Boudinot's A Star in the West. I can't remember the exact page, but it's in there. And the other one is hearsay. I've just heard people say that Joseph had related something to his father, but I can't find it myself. I can't find a hard original document to that effect. Yes,
I realize this is a class on the first visitation, but you have referred to Ethan Smith in the view of the Hebrews.
Right.
So it seems to be Book of Mormon related.
Right. Well, the last 5 minutes or 10 minutes was Book of Mormon. You know.
Okay, well, may I ask then up front, and I'm a broken record to Sam and some other people present, equally I wrote and asked, never got an answer. Will the day come when one can be a good Mormon and not take the book with the golden plates literally? Maybe you'll speak to that subject.
Well, I first believe that Joseph Smith crafted the Book of Mormon. I don't believe he stole any material parts of it from anyone else in particular. I think that Oliver Cowdery was a part of the interaction. I think Joseph had the ability to draft the Book of Mormon without any plates, without any shear stones, without any paraphernalia of any type, just as he could craft that letter to Joseph Knight. He basically had essentially all the material. Now, a lot of people had all the material. And if we allow for any sort of spiritual intervention on anything, and really that's all Joseph really purports in the front page or the front panel for the Book of Mormon, was basically the record of the Nephites and others translated through the Spirit, you know. And so if we cut any slack to intervention of the Spirit, then the paraphernalia is more for show than requirement, in my view. It's my own personal view. But the Mormon mythology is so heavily built on almost artifacts and physical manifestations. Let's just make the point that it's rather clear in looking at the eight witnesses that they needed something physical if they were going to get on board. And so if there were golden plates, if there was that type of physical thing, they were probably more needed by other people than by Joseph himself. So I think it's a matter of looking at the whole context, and I think the points are well made that we have a tendency to do lookbacks from today and reconstruct our history to make Mormon history easier to deal with. And I'm not sure that anyone in the offices across town are willing to give up the artifacts.
Thanks for your attendance. We thank Richard and John for their participation.